You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, making a New Year's resolution can be a daunting task. It can be tempting to make little changes here and there, but our guest says, no, go big to change your life. First, is cable news bad for our health? One fitness chain seems to think so. Minnesota-based Lifetime Fitness recently announced it would stop showing cable news on their gym's communal televisions, saying in a statement that cable news consumption is not part of a, quote, healthy way of life. That means Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC will no longer appear on the club's big screen TVs, though the channels will still be viewable on smaller screens installed in some of the equipment. There's been a lot of reaction for and against the idea, but what about the basic concept? Can news consumption be bad for our well-being? Mary McNaughton Castle is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at San Antonio. She's the author of Mind the Gap, Coping with Stress in the Modern World. Her research focuses on the psychological effects of media consumption. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, what do you think of this idea? A gym saying, hey, we're all about health and well-being, and cable news, not part of that in our gym.
I actually support the choice. I think the problem in gyms and public settings is that there are such differences in cable news channels that one of the problems is that people may be exposed to a channel that is not of their choice. But the other thing is that we are already inundated with information, and there need to be some times in our lives when we're exercising or doing other things where we're not just being bombarded.
What do we know about the connection between news consumption and stress?
The research that I've done and a lot of other people have done doesn't suggest that watching the news per se will make you clinically depressed or clinically anxious, but it will exacerbate how you feel already. So if you are depressed or anxious, it can make it worse. And in fact, sometimes depressed and anxious people sort of find themselves watching the news because they're not doing other things. And then the other piece of it is it kind of can contribute to a bit of a malaise, sort of a general feeling that things are just not good and not getting better and never going to improve. And I think that is actually one of the most common things that people tell me about watching the news.
Is there something about how accessible news is now? We could, there are 24-hour news channels. We could literally watch every minute of the day. Twitter, we could scroll down infinitely. A lot of news sites the same way. We can get all the news we can get our hands on.
Absolutely. I mean, you can go back in history to times when battles were fought after a war had ended because the news couldn't travel fast enough to tell people. And now, not only can we get 24-hour coverage, but there really isn't enough information, so a lot of that coverage is recycled over and over, and that plays into some of the things our brain does. You know, the more often we hear something, the more likely we are later to remember it and to think it's true, even if it's not. And part of what the news channels have to do to compete is be sensational and grab our attention, and so they tend to go with things that are negative or disturbing because they know we'll look at them. And they don't tend to spend as much time on the follow-up or how it got resolved or whether something turned out all right in the end.
So we get the bad, but not necessarily how it ended, maybe the good that might have come out of it later.
Absolutely. And when you think about it in your own life, you know about the bad things in your community or your kid's school or your job, but you also see the people who are doing good things and the solutions and the issues that get resolved. And the problem with a news diet is that we never see that backside. It's a very one-dimensional picture of how things are going.
Talking to Mary McNaughton Castle from the University of Texas at San Antonio. She's a psychology professor. We're looking at the impacts of news consumption, too much news consumption, on our stress levels after a gym chain, a fitness chain, banned news channels from their workout rooms. I want to go to a caller. We've got Tom on the line with us in Columbus. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon, both. I was in a position as a semi-driver, local, so I was home every night, but I was doing 12 to 14-hour days and listening to the radio quite a bit in between stops. And there, I have since changed careers, and you know, I spend way less time behind the wheel, way less time consuming that audio news off of whichever channel I happen to be on at the time, XM, terrestrial, what have you. I could tell personally my stress level has fallen considerably. Hmm. And again, I agree that so much, a lot of the stories are somewhat shallow, but there is so much information out there. And, you know, you can go to proverbial, the church that you agree with. You can listen to the crowd that, you know, makes you mad, so you listen longer. It's mind-boggling. And it really, I've gone to just taking my news from NPR and PBS and a few offshore sites, and I find my stress level has dropped considerably, and I'm no less informed than I was before.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. And Mary, let's talk about what Tom did and what you recommend people do if they are feeling like they're having news stress. How can we manage our news consumption better?
I love his story because he illustrates the point that you can take control of your exposure. In his case, his job might have changed, but one of the things I tell my students all the time is that we're not going to go back in time to an era when we weren't surrounded by news, so we have to take personal responsibility for titrating what we hear and see. And part of that's understanding what's upsetting to you. In my case, I don't like visuals. And on TV, by the time you see something really graphic, it's too late. So like your caller, I try to get most of my news from the radio or even from the internet where I can control it. And I think people vary. But we need to be thinking about that consciously and making choices instead of just kind of going with tide and letting the news wash over us all the time.
Do you have thoughts on how, say, a TV news network might be able to help people out to still do their job and in theory get viewers, but to make it less stressful?
Yeah, that is a tough question. Part of it is not the news producer's fault, because the economics of competing for viewers in a 24-hour world with reality shows and everything else means that you do have to have hooks. There's a group of journalists. It's a website called Solutions Journalism, and I think they are doing some really good work about advocating for just more follow-up. So if there's a problem, follow up later and show what worked, what didn't. Give people a sense that not everything that looks like a disaster is necessarily going to turn out in the worst possible way.
And I wanted to talk about that, the disaster or tragedy, like a really big one. I've had the same experience I assume a lot of people have, where you feel obliged to keep looking for the latest news on a newspaper website, Twitter, TV, whatever. How do we cut ourselves off from that when it's clearly not going to help us and we're not helping anybody by following that?
Well, that's the trick right there. You know, in the past, when disasters happened, you were either living through them and it was horrible for you, but there were things you could do in the real world, or you didn't know about them. There have always been earthquakes and disasters and tragedies, but people didn't know about everyone happening all over the world. So you do need to set yourself a schedule. You can check in on the news or have set feeds or however you look at it, but you don't have to keep it constantly going on in the background. But I think what's even more important is to find a way to feel a sense of control. So if you see a disaster that affects you, you may not be able to go to Puerto Rico or wherever the people are suffering, but maybe you could make a donation or you could do something to help people in your community. The idea is to take some control and make a difference, because that's what makes us feel less helpless or hopeless or overwhelmed.
And I want to ask you, Mary, on a personal level, you study this, you've written about it, clearly you know what's going on here, but do you still find yourself sometimes breaking your rules and getting sucked back into watching too much news?
I do. It's hard not to, and it creeps into your Facebook and everything else. But what I try very hard to do is find ways to feel like I'm part of the solution and not just the problem. In my case, I do disaster mental health work, so I'm actually going down to Puerto Rico next week with a group. And that doesn't mean we're going to help everyone or it fixes the next disaster, but it helps me to feel that I'm doing something to improve the overall picture.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And best of luck with your work in Puerto Rico.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Mary McNaughton Castle, professor of psychology at the University of Texas at San Antonio. She's the author of Mind the Gap, Coping with Stress in the Modern World. She joined us to talk about the relationship between news consumption, stress, and mental health after a chain of fitness centers announced they're not going to show cable news in their facilities anymore. We're at the midway point in January, and it's time to ask, how are you doing with those New Year's resolutions? If you're finding it difficult to stick with it, you're not alone. The conventional wisdom is that when we make New Year's resolutions, we should make small ones in order to achieve our goals, get some wins in the books there. But our next guest says people should actually make big changes and do it all at once. Christopher Wharton is with us now. He's an associate professor in the Arizona State University College of Health Solutions. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, Chris, I definitely am of that mindset that says pick something small. Like mine was get my new calendar up before the end of January. Nailed it. But you say we should be thinking bigger. Why is that?
Yeah, and it's not that, you know, a baby steps approach is necessarily wrong, but we do find that a lot of people who try to make small changes, you know, one thing at a time, make that attempt and perhaps succeed at it for a while, but oftentimes find themselves failing at that small change approach. And so one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is why is it that we make that recommendation? And it's probably because, you know, a lot of behavior change researchers like myself, we tend to conduct science in that reductionist way. We're looking for, you know, mechanisms of action we can prove to be effective. So we do interventions where we make small changes for people and see how that works. And so we end up going out to the public and saying, this is the approach you should take. But what's interesting is there's been some recent research to suggest that we have much greater capacity for more sort of larger changes and even multiple changes at once than maybe we give ourselves credit for. There was a study conducted about a year ago where people were put into a really intensive behavior change intervention where they didn't just change one small thing, like say just a diet, but they changed their diet, their physical activity, their sleeping behaviors, their stress management, even the way they managed healthy relationships. And what those researchers found were dramatic positive changes both in physical and mental health. So it may be the case that our capacity for change is really great, and as such, we might have an opportunity for much bigger changes than we normally think we could pull off.
And reading some of what you've written about this, Chris, it sounds like if we're making those little changes, we might be dealing with, in a way, a symptom, whereas if we tackle the big stuff, we're going to dig down into what's causing the behaviors we don't like.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you think about making small changes, you know, and the ways that people fail at this, because unfortunately, a lot of people fail at whether it's New Year's resolutions, you know, taking on new diets, trying to join a gym. Why do we fail at those small behavior changes? If you think about it from sort of a systems perspective, sort of a lifestyle-wide perspective, you make this change, but you do it in a context, a social context, an environmental context that's built still to support the behaviors you used to engage in, not the new one that you're trying to achieve. So making the small change, you're almost setting yourself up for a big fight against what is already built to sort of fight against you. It may be the case that if we reorient really how we live in that context, we might give ourselves a better chance. And reorienting ourselves probably means that we think more about how we behave in multiple different ways, not just a single way. And so when I mention that environment, really what I'm talking about is really an environment of normalized excess. You know, and when we think about like health behaviors, that's an area that a lot of people like to focus on when it comes to New Year's resolutions. The environment that we're operating in is one that we see as normal because everybody eats similar foods, mainly for convenience. Everybody tends to drive wherever they need to go, whether it's a quarter mile or even 40 miles. We all tend to passively entertain ourselves. You know, I was listening to your guest on the previous segment. We tend to watch a lot of TV. We have a lot of screen time. All of that feels normal, but it's not that it's, you know, it's just that sort of normalized, but still it could be incredibly excessive. So, for example, Americans actually on average watch about 5 hours of television a day, and we actually spend more time in our cars than we do outside. And these are things, when you hear it that way, it's actually sort of shocking, but this is what we've normalized into our lives. And of course, those are examples of sedentary behavior, which we know to be very bad for health. So it's really about thinking about our whole context and thinking, you know, what do I need to do to actually shift all of my behaviors in this context that sets me up to be usually unhealthy and perhaps unhappy and stressed, as your last segment was describing, oftentimes financially strapped and even impacting the environment in very negative ways.
Talking to Christopher Wharton from Arizona State University, he's talking about how we can make changes in ourselves, whether that's a New Year's resolution or any time of year. He says, don't go small, go big and find out some fundamental ways to accomplish what you want to change in your life. Let's take an example, Chris. I think a lot of people generally think, oh, I want to try to get more exercise. I want to exercise more. I can't find the time to do it. I don't know how to fit it into my life. And then eventually that just kind of withers away. What would be another way to think about that?
Yeah, that's a great example, because oftentimes, you know, one of the first things we think of is, let's go join a gym. You know, I haven't given myself the time to be physically active, so I'll go join a gym, and I'm going to force fit that extra 30, 45 minutes or an hour into my day, and that's going to work. And, of course, for a lot of people, unfortunately, that doesn't work. And so rather than thinking about it that way, we might think about attacking, again, these behaviors that we see as normal but maybe actually be very excessive. So the opposite of physical activity is sedentary behavior or not moving, and some of the key drivers I've just mentioned. So TV watching is a really good example of this. Now, if we watch on average 5 hours of television a day, what we know about that actually from really good epidemiological work, controlling for other health behaviors, every hour increase in TV watching increases our risk for cardiovascular disease and cardiovascular disease-related death significantly. So removing or eliminating some TV time, reducing screen time, does multiple things at once. First of all, it eliminates some sedentary behavior that we know is bad for health. But then it opens up time. And this is where I get into the notion of multiple behavior changes all at once. If we removed or even eliminated TV-related time, what could you do with those extra hours? You might decide it could just be an extra conversation with your kids and your family, when we know, of course, social interaction is actually going down over time, but it's really important for health. It could also mean that you have time to go for a walk or a run. It could actually mean that you prep a dinner at home or maybe a healthy lunch for the next day at work. These are things that, you know, lack of time is one of the excuses we give ourselves for not engaging in healthier behaviors. But just ditching a TV or reducing screen time actually could have a sort of a cascading effect where you could then engage in lots of different healthy behaviors all at once that start to support each other in a broader-based sort of lifestyle change.
Seems like one of the parts of this is taking a look at that, say, screen time, the time we spend on TV, and thinking, was it fulfilling? Was 5 hours twice as good as 2.5 hours of TV? Like, was that time well spent? Is that part of the equation?
Yeah. And oftentimes when I talk about this, because it can feel very counterintuitive, right? The idea of changing lots of things in big ways seems very scary. And so why would we attempt to do this instead of doing small things? If you back it up, you know, the question you just asked is really something about values. And this is an approach to behavior change we don't often think of at the outset, but is really fundamentally, I think, important. And so it's really about, you know, how do we spend our time, and actually, how do we spend our money on our behaviors, the things we engage in day in and day out? And we usually do that passively. Again, we just sort of glom onto whatever the social norms are for those things. But if we step back and thought about what we really value, and then we looked at how we allocate our time and maybe even money in our budget to our behaviors, are those, you know, expending those precious resources of value, or I'm sorry, of time and money, do they actually reflect our values? We might find that, in fact, that's not the case, that, you know, we'd much rather value spending time with people and taking walks with people than watching multiple hours of TV, but maybe we're doing the reverse. So if we think about our values, which of course don't adhere to just one behavior but multiple behaviors at once, that may give us a platform for an easier approach to multiple behavior changes that can elicit improvements in health and happiness, financial security, and even environmental sustainability in some cases.
Well, it sounds like we need to get a little philosophical here then, Chris, and ask ourselves, what do we value? What is good in life? How do we sit down and come up with, I don't know, a mission statement that tells us how we want to spend our time?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I've written a little bit about this. It sounds kind of cheesy, but you could even approach this from a strategic planning perspective. So, you know, when we engage in projects we think are important, usually we try to plan them out, of course. Well, what project could be more important to us than how we live our lives, right? So one thing we can actually do is sit down and literally think through a strategic plan for your life. And you might start out by envisioning what it is you're trying to do in your life. What do you want to accomplish? And from there, you could think about, okay, so what are the goals I'd like to meet in order to work towards that vision? And what are the values that, you know, would support those goals? And you could literally go through essentially creating a vision statement for yourself and creating a strategic plan. And that might begin to identify specifically for yourself and for your own situation the strategies, the opportunities you have to make changes that could better reflect your values, your interests, and that probably more naturally will lead to healthier outcomes, happier outcomes, and the like.
All right, Chris, we do this. We know the things we want to do, but there's a lot of good TV out there. How do we make sure that, you know, if there's something that we do like about that, that it it can be part of our lives, but not take over all that time we want to crack out of it.
Yeah, so I have some radical recommendations when it comes to this. First things first, let's talk about dealing with TV. So 96% of American households own a TV. A large percentage of those actually own three or four or more TVs within a single household. So it infuses our life, right? It feels like we can't, and your previous segment referred to this too, it feels like we can't really get away from, you know, these outlets of information. One of the ways to go about this, and I often refer to, you know, there's this idea of behavioral change called nudging, where we try to subtly move people in a certain direction. This would be my idea of shoving, which is to radically change your environment so that you can much more easily control those inputs. So I would recommend, for example, ditching your TVs entirely, literally cutting off cable, getting the screens out of your home. Now, that doesn't mean you can't engage in the things that you enjoy, right? So most people have multiple different devices in their house. They have phones, they have, you know, tablets, they have computers, and probably also TVs. But usually it's the TV around which we orient our whole lives. If you look at a standard living room, you know, couches are arranged around this thing. But if the TV is gone, that becomes an environment where the default is not to passively sit and watch TV. Instead, you have to sort of actively engage, and that might mean you start using subscriptions on your computer to watch certain television shows. And you have to be much more active about choosing the content that you want to engage in that way, rather than just popping the TV on and flipping around. And so that would give you a lot more control and probably, as a result, naturally minimize the amount of screen time you might be engaging in.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today. A lot of good food for thought.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Christopher Wharton, associate professor in the Arizona State University College of Health Solutions. He made the case for making big changes instead of small ones when we make New Year's resolutions or just want to change our lives in general. States can require certain people receiving Medicaid coverage to have a job, go to school, or perform community service. The Trump administration said last week that it would support states seeking to make those changes, and it marks a reversal from previous administration's stance on the program. Wisconsin is among 10 states, including Kentucky, Arizona, and Indiana, that have already requested a waiver that would allow them to change the requirements. Kentucky's plan got federal approval last Friday. Donna Friedsam is with us now. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, tell us what was in this move from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. What are they telling states?
The Trump administration is interested in moving away from the idea of Medicaid and health coverage, the health coverage provided by government programs, as being what's considered an entitlement, to being something that people are on very temporarily and perhaps working to get off of it, or meriting being on it, and particularly for people that they consider to be what they refer to as able-bodied adults. They are not interested in seeing those people particularly attached to those programs where they might otherwise be, in their minds, participating in the economy in other ways. So I think that's what's behind the thinking of the administration in seeking to expand these programs, and as well the idea that it will move Medicaid beneficiaries into the workforce and perhaps out of poverty. That's the thinking that they are advancing and improving these, or in approving these kinds of requests from states.
Let's look at big picture what Medicaid does. It serves a whole lot of different populations, it seems like. Can you talk about the scope of people who receive Medicaid support, Donna?
Right. Medicaid now is the largest source of health insurance coverage in the country, and it covers not only what we typically think of with the low-income pregnant women and children, but also the elderly and disabled in long-term care. It's the largest source of coverage. It covers, and now with expansion under the Affordable Care Act, a number of adults who previously did not have coverage, adults whose children have aged out of dependency so they don't have dependent children in the home, have gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion. So with all of that, we have about more than 70 million people in our country that are in some way attached to the Medicaid program in Wisconsin. Over one in five people have a relationship to, or some kind of dependence on the Medicaid program.
And when we talk about these possible work requirements in states, we're not talking about the single parent with a child who's receiving Medicaid support, not talking about the person with disabilities or the elderly person. They wouldn't be covered under this work requirement. Is that correct?
Well, there may be disabled people that end up in there if they haven't yet qualified or have not qualified under the federal disability laws, but do have some kinds of functional disabilities. They may get swept up into some kinds of work requirements at the federal in other states, but Wisconsin's request is a little bit different, or actually substantially different in many ways than Kentucky's. So if we're speaking broadly, there are ways that people have some functional disabilities where they may not necessarily meet the federal definition of disabled. But in general, these current requests for work requirements on Medicaid members are targeted toward what the federal government is referring to as able-bodied childless adults. They may be, but again, that may include people with various physical or mental health challenges.
Talking to Donna Friedsam from the UW Population Health Institute, looking at the new guideline from the Trump administration saying states, we will allow you to require work or volunteering or other things from Medicaid recipients, able-bodied Medicaid recipients. I want to compare and contrast a couple different plans here. Donna, you mentioned Wisconsin is different from what's going on in Kentucky. Let's actually start in Kentucky because this is the first one that got this waiver from the federal government. What does their plan look like?
So Kentucky's plan is pretty substantial in requiring that its members or these adults actually enroll or who would like to enroll in Medicaid have some kind of employment or what they're calling a community engagement function in order to have that Medicaid coverage. So it's actually directly linked to their eligibility. And it also has a whole range of other components to the waiver, including cost sharing and premiums and other changes to the Medicaid program for this population. But it really specifically and directly links immediate participation in employment or other community volunteer or other community participation programs to immediate eligibility, which is very different than the way the Wisconsin waiver is set up. It has a more kind of distant relationship between employment and immediate eligibility.
Yeah, let's look at this Wisconsin waiver. This is something that the state had applied for under the Obama administration. The Obama administration was not approving these waivers. The Trump administration, at least if Kentucky is an indication, is approving them. So what would Wisconsin's plan look like if it got the waiver?
So Wisconsin's plan is not so explicitly a requirement of work for eligibility. Instead, what they did is they linked the work to a time limit in Medicaid eligibility. So what they set out in the current request, which has not yet been approved by the Trump administration, is a 48-month, which is a four-year time limit for enrollment in the program. And if the member participates, as they're expected to do, in these various community engagement activities, being work or volunteer they allow education or other activities, then that stops the clock on this 48-month limit. So the member won't lose their eligibility if they're not participating in this employment, but the clock will tick against their 48-month limit. So the member can still have the coverage in Medicaid, but they will be subject to this 48-month limit. And again, if they do participate in these employment activities or employment-related or volunteer-related activities, then that will stop the clock, and they could have a longer period of eligibility for Medicaid coverage.
And to clarify, I understand a lot of people in Wisconsin who receive Medicaid might not know that they're receiving Medicaid. They'd be getting it through the state's Badger Care program. Is that right?
Right. There's a lot of there's so many different words. There's Medicaid, there's Badger Care, and in fact, many members their card actually says Forward Health on it. So there's a lot of, or they, it may actually say the name of their carrier. It may say, Unity Health Plans or the like on it. So there's a lot of confusion. But these are the people that are qualifying through our state's Medicaid and Badger Care programs. Correct.
I understand it's been raised as a concern, in part from the private insurance companies who administer things like Badger Care or Medicaid, whatever they're called in a particular place. They're worried about having to do the administrative work to figure out if that person who's applying fulfills the work or volunteer or educational or whatever requirement.
Well, the people that handle this would be on the enrollment services entity. And so people would be going through an enrollment process, and then generally they every year have to have their enrollment renewed. And generally the state has a different kind of contractor that handles enrollment and re-enrollment that is not specific to the actual health plan that people enroll in. So, but not to say this is not an administrative burden, because there's a lot written about the various administrative burdens associated with trying to assure that people are adhering to various requirements around work or volunteer or paying premiums and the like, and that certainly exists. But it wouldn't necessarily fall on the provider themselves. The issue that does arise is whether it would could potentially interfere with continuity of care and the like. But again, I want to emphasize that Wisconsin's proposal is structured very differently than Kentucky's proposal in the way it does at least allow for this 48-month period of eligibility, and then the member has the opportunity to stop the clock on that 48-month limit if they participate in employment. There's also a number of exceptions, both in Kentucky, I should say, and in Wisconsin, to the work requirement. All that being said, we have yet to understand whether this is something that's going to deter people from even applying for the program. It needs to be understood that now that 60% of individuals who are of non-elderly adults who don't have children and are not disabled, who are currently enrolled in the Medicaid program, are currently employed. And those who are not employed, the reasons that are reported that they are home are that they report that they themselves are ill or disabled, or that they're caring for a needy family member, or that they're in school. So we don't know how many people are actually going to end up qualifying for an exception or being subject to this at all, or whether this is going to deter people just because they don't understand that they won't lose their eligibility. We don't know what the effects will be.
Donna Friedsam is with us. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She's with us to talk about potential changes that could come to Medicaid as states start to seek or continue to seek waivers now getting approved by the Trump administration, including work requirements for able-bodied recipients, as we're hearing that would work differently in different states. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this proposed work requirement requiring able-bodied people who are receiving Medicaid to be employed or volunteering, as is in the Kentucky plan, or at least using it to set the clock for when benefits might run out, should those changes happen here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. And are you one of the people who would be affected by this? Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about work requirements that could come to Medicaid, known as Badger Care here in Wisconsin. Our guest is Donna Friedsam. She's a researcher and health policy programs director at the UW Population Health Institute. As we've heard, Kentucky got their waiver approved. They're going to have this work requirement. Wisconsin has a waiver filed with the federal government. It would work differently. If you worked, it would change your eligibility over time. There's a benefit to working. It's not an instant cutoff, though, if you don't work. Call 800-642-1234. Do you think Medicaid should have a work requirement, especially for able-bodied recipients? Why or why not? Do you want to see these changes here in Wisconsin to Badger Care, which is how Medicaid comes to the state? Call in at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to our callers now. Ray is on the line in Rhinelander. Ray, hi.
Hi, I'm really glad that you have this honor presenting this. Once again, this administration likes to push things through without thinking about cause and effect. Nothing new.
Ray, thanks for the call. Donna, do you think enough thought is being put into these programs and how they're being implemented?
Well, there's certainly a lot of debate on both sides of the issue about what the costs and benefits are to people, as well as to the state budgets and federal budget. I will say that what you'll see right now is a debate about whether work improves health or whether health allows people to work. And so I don't know. I think that there's a lot of people that are putting a lot of thought into this, but whether people are speaking the same language, that's certainly highly debatable right now. And so, you know, what we see now is the idea that the administration is trying to advance the idea that work itself is health promoting, and that is consistent with the goals of the Medicaid program. Whereas typically, you know, people who have advocated that the Medicaid program is a health program and not a work program have said we need to be making sure people connect with coverage so they can be healthy, and that will allow them to work. And there's this idea that the reason we see people who work being healthier is that you need to have a basic level of health in order to work.
Thanks for the call, Ray. We'll go next to Cindy on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I find it very interesting that after Wisconsin gave $330 million or billion, whatever it is, to Foxconn, and our federal government approves this new tax plan that gives corporations big tax breaks, now they're sticking it to the poor.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Donna, as you're saying, there's uncertainty as to whether people would ultimately be removed from Badger Care or Medicaid if this waiver were passed. What would we need to know whether this would knock a lot of people off of Badger Care here in Wisconsin or similar programs in other states?
Well, I will say that in terms of the budget projections that the state has put out, as well as Kentucky, I should add, both our state and Kentucky have put out projections that there will be a decline in enrollment. I think both states are expecting that these programs will move people off of the Medicaid enrollment list. But the question is, why are they imagining that? It could be that they imagine that people are going to be moving into work, improving their incomes, possibly getting insurance and other opportunities. Or it could be that they're imagining that the program will serve as a deterrent and that poor people will just go away and not gain coverage, which many people would not see as a desirable outcome, but would in fact have the effect of reducing the number of people enrolled and possibly saving money, at least in the short term, for the state. We don't know what the effect will be. I will note that what we know is that, like I said, 60% of people, of these childless adults in that age range currently enrolled in Medicaid are currently on Medicaid and working, so their employment situation is not itself providing them with an affordable health insurance option. So we don't know if people get attached to employment, will that be a road to better economic circumstances and private health insurance options, or will they remain needing health state coverage for health insurance regardless? We don't know that.
We're talking to Donna Friedsam from the UW Population Health Institute, looking at work requirements for Medicaid. The Trump administration says it will accept at least some waivers. It's already accepted one from Kentucky. Wisconsin has a different plan, a waiver request out there. Back to your calls now. Debbie is on the line in Nisita. Debbie, hi.
Hi. Yeah, hi. I didn't have the radio on just for this last minute. I think your previous call may have had a very similar question to mine. In central Wisconsin, with the paper industry and a lot of the industries leaving the area, you have a large amount of people over 55 but are not, you know, near 65 who are underemployed or longtime unemployed based upon the industry has left the area. And I guess is that with that four-year thing that I overheard on the radio here, as well, it's people are in their 59 or so are not in, by the time they're 70 will be longer than 4 years from now. I'm worried about what they will do for coverage. It will get worse for them.
Debbie, I got you. I want to get Donna in on this. So people in that 50s age range with low employment areas, what do you think?
These provisions only apply to people between the ages of 19 and 49 for the state of Wisconsin's waiver.
Okay. And how about Kentucky's waiver? Do you know, is it the same age range?
I have to admit that I don't have that detail.
Sorry, and I don't have it in front of me either.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call, Debbie. Thanks for bringing that up. We'll go next to Jean in Little Chute. Jean, hi.
Hi. Hi. I just have a comment. My son, he is 34 years old, and he's schizophrenic. And he has a hard time holding a job. He'll get a job. It just doesn't work out. He quits. But you know what? I'm glad that he works. Because if he didn't work, he would be at home ruminating in his mental health issues, which makes a very unhealthy person. And when you say between 18 and 49, you said, I think people need to work. They need to have a purpose. I work with older people that you know, 70s and 80s. And I see when these people don't have a purpose, they become very, very sad. And I know with my son, too. I mean, he goes stir crazy when he's not working.
Jean, thanks for the call. Donna, an argument in favor of that argument from the administration you were talking about earlier, that being out in the public on the job, having that purpose, could be a health benefit.
Certainly for some people will certainly argue that, and you'll certainly hear other stories that suggest that some people feel that it's not a possibility. I think, you know, these are the kinds of human stories that you hear on all sides of the issue, and we'll have to see as the data come in about whether this is working for people or whether this, you know, is actually keeping people out. But I will say that, I think it's going to be important to understand that how different Wisconsin's waiver request is from Kentucky's. There is a long list of exceptions to the work requirement in Wisconsin's waiver. And it'll be interesting to see how much the waiver requirements apply, or whether it possibly creating a deterrent for people who don't understand that they are not subject to these requirements. We don't know.
And briefly, Donna, do you expect more states to get waivers in the short run?
Well, I think we certainly will see some momentum by the existing states that have waiver requests in, and then possibly understanding how the Trump administration, what they favor versus disfavor in terms of the provisions, and other states possibly trying to mirror those provisions. Yeah.
Donna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Donna Friedsam, researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute. She was with us today to talk about new Medicaid guidelines from the Trump administration that could allow states to impose work requirements on certain recipients of Medicaid.